From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I talk with jazz pianist Marianne McPartland. As a British woman instrumentalist, she initially was considered out of place in the world of jazz. Also today, I speak with Michael Denneny, the editor of Stonewall Inn Editions, a series of books by gay authors that exemplifies the publishing industry's growing recognition of gay writers and gay readers. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back on the career of the Chantels, one of rock and roll's first girl groups. And John Leonard reviews Beloved, the first novel in 7 years from Toni Morrison. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Marianne McPartland, one of the few women instrumentalists who has made it in the very male world of jazz. Her following has grown over the past few years as a result of her Peabody Award-winning National Public Radio series, Marianne McPartland's Piano Jazz. If there is such a thing as the jazz life, McPartland's background was not the perfect preparation for it. She grew up in England, in a proper upper-middle-class home, where classical music was appreciated while jazz was heartily disapproved of. She moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. For the first few years of their 20-year marriage, she played Dixieland standards with her husband, but since the early 50s, she's led her own small groups, playing more modern music. Over the years, McPartland has written profiles of fellow musicians. They've been published in jazz magazines, and now these pieces are collected in her new book, All in Good Time, which is published by the Oxford University Press. She also has a new album of music by Billy Strayhorn on the Concord record label. We're going to hear an excerpt of that album in a couple of minutes. Marianne McPartland, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Terry. It's nice to be here.
Before we talk about your life, I feel like we should play a duet together, like on your show, but no.
Yeah, why not? We've got a piano. Here, let's try four hands.
Before we talk about your life, I'd like to play an excerpt of your new album of music by Billy Strayhorn. And Strayhorn was Duke Ellington's closest collaborator. He wrote Lush Life and Take the A-Train, Daydream. When you were playing at the Hickory House on 52nd Street in New York, he used to come and hear you sometimes, right?
Yes, he did, often.
Would he comment on your interpretations of his pieces?
It's funny, so many people ask me that. It seems like it would be a natural thing to do, but Billy was such a sweet man and such a charitable, kind soul. You couldn't imagine him ever saying, well, that was nice, but you should do this. And so he always just listened and smiled and would say, oh, that was very lovely, or I enjoyed that, or you played it beautifully. He never, ever offered any kind of criticism at all.
Let's hear an excerpt of a beautiful interpretation that you do of Strayhorn's Daydream, and this is from the new album. Marianne McPartland plays the music of Billy Strayhorn.
Thank you.
Pianist Marian McPartland from her new album of the music of Billy Strayhorn. It's a really very beautiful recording.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. So many of your listeners on radio have heard you talk with other musicians about their lives. I want to hear some about yours. I know you came from a pretty proper family in England. Your mother played classical music and I think wished that you played classical music too. They didn't like the idea of you playing jazz. What did it represent to your parents?
I don't think they minded. I don't think they minded what I played. It was just when they got the idea that I was going to do something in music that they weren't going to see me get what they thought would be a nice job. Like my father always thought it would be nice if I worked in a bank or became a nurse, of all ridiculous things. And they really didn't mind me playing jazz, but when they finally got the word that I was going to be in it, then it became a different thing, music as a profession.
What did they object to about that?
Oh, just the idea of... I think my mother said, what was it? Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll marry a musician and live in an attic. See, that's pretty much what happened. Although we weren't ever in the attic, but we were in some funny little apartments. But that was her idea, that I would meet terrible people and that I would come to no good, you know, that it would represent something depraved.
Did your teachers in music school feel the same way?
When I finally studied the 3 years that I did take lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, I played by ear up until that time. When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something. And he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, and, "Stop playing that trash!" So I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time. But it really wasn't long after that I left and took off with a four-piano act that was my first introduction to not so much the jazz life, but the show business life. And actually, now I'm rather proud of having worked in all those vaudeville theaters because they're very historical places, those of them that are still standing.
Probably gave you some stage confidence also.
Well, yes, and how to act and talk on a microphone, although doing the piano show helped a lot more.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then actually after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people. And, of course, because of Jimmy, working with his group. I certainly have a fine Dixieland repertoire, and we still play together, and we still play all those tunes.
Well, when you started playing, you were playing with your husband's band.
Yes.
And I wonder if it was hard for you to get your own sense of identity as a performer. I think a lot of women who are married to someone who they work with, especially a few decades ago, were considered the wife of, and kind of secondary to, the man who was performing. Did that ever happen?
It's funny. I guess I must have been naturally pushy or something. Plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent. And he was always kind of introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He seemed to be very proud of what I did. In fact, when we moved to New York, it was really through Jimmy that I got started with the trio, because I really didn't want to. He kept saying, oh, you ought to have your own trio, and you shouldn't be working in this band. I could feel myself getting out of the Dixieland chord structure and into more modern things. And, of course, I listened to everything that was going on all the time. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio. And once I did start with the trio, Jimmy was very helpful in introducing me to all kinds of people. And I always tell him he created a monster because, you know, once I started, I didn't want to stop. That was it.
Well, some jazz musicians remain sidemen all their lives. They spend their lives playing with other people's bands.
That's true.
Very early on in your career, you became a leader. How did you manage to pull that off?
Well, working with Jimmy is sort of, I mean, working with your own husband, I mean, it in many ways, it was a very comfortable situation. And starting with the trio, I guess what happened was that I got booked in this one place, the Embers, and so since I had been booked as the leader, I was able to hire the people to work with me, and from then on it always was that way. I was always booked and as the leader, and would hire the best. I always wanted the best sidemen there were available. As a matter of fact, in a way, I'm kind of sorry that I didn't, what I would call, go through the ranks and be a side man or side person with some other groups. But it just didn't work out that way, because I went right from working with Jimmy to my own trio. And it was very hard because it was a top club, and I felt that I was very green and callow. And it's funny, I couldn't open my mouth. I remember we had my group, and Eddie Haywood was opposite me, and I couldn't even think what to say to introduce him. I had it written on a piece of paper. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And now I'd like to introduce Eddie Haywood. And, you know, I would do it, and I would be shaking. It was so funny. But, you know, we went. I guess you learn by doing, you know.
Jimmy McPartland used to drink a lot.
Yes, he sure did.
Did you ever feel, since you were his wife, when you were playing together on the bandstand, that you had to keep one eye on how much he was drinking?
Oh, Terry, that's a whole other... I mean, if you ever want to do a show on alcoholism and AA, I could talk about that. I mean, Jimmy finally went into AA, and I was probably a terrible person because I was always nagging and worrying about that. It just seems like there's always somebody around, a person who drinks a lot. There's always some sort of well-meaning do-gooder trying to keep them straight, and that was me.
Well, that must have put a real strain on your performing, to on the one hand be playing, and on the other hand trying to keep track of what was happening with your husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many anecdotes I could tell about that. At this point, they seem funny, though at the time they weren't, because, you know, when somebody's drinking, they always have a million friends who want to make sure that they buy them drinks and they get their quota. You know, Jimmy would walk around the bar and tell everybody that his wife couldn't stand to see him drink, and so his friends would say, oh, that's terrible. You know, they would carry a water glass full of gin into the men's room. And I never could figure out how he got... Although Jimmy wasn't sort of a falling down drunk. He just got very slow and boring, you know. And the worst thing that would happen would be he'd be announcing a tune, and it would take him 10 minutes to announce the tune, and we'd all be saying, oh, for God's sake, get on with it, you know. No, that's a whole other side of my life, and it seems to have, in retrospect, as I say, a lot of it seems very funny, though at the time it was quite a tragedy, but it's great. It worked out because he did stop, and he has a very healthy life. He's a very healthy person, and so many of the musicians that he worked with are gone, probably because of that. You know, a lot of people died too young. So not so with the old man. He's in good shape.
Did that have anything to do with your wanting to lead your own trio and getting out of playing with him?
No, I don't think so. Not at that time. I don't think so. I think it was just inside me there was this real, must have been this real determined ambition to get ahead. It must have been there because I notice I've always done things consciously or unconsciously to sort of get ahead. And I'm somebody who, as they say, likes to take care of business, you know,
right.
the phone calls and all the things that are really such an important part of doing a job. You can't be late, and you've got to be well rehearsed and know what you're doing at all times.
My guest is jazz pianist Marian McPartland, who you may know as the host of Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz on national public radio stations around the country. She has two big occasions in her life now, the publication of a new book called All in Good Time, which features her profiles of some of her fellow jazz musicians. That's just published on Oxford University Press. And she has a new album of the music of Billy Strayhorn on Concord Records. We're going to talk some more about her life after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Pianist Marian McPartland is my guest. You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career, and I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown. So that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so. They would.
You know what might have been helpful to you, too, being married to a jazz musician? And what I mean by that is that you weren't, quote, available to any man who thinks, well, I think I'll flirt with that dame pianist, you know, because I'm
no, that's true. That's true. You know, and then there's this to it also, Terry, that when I did get out with my own trio, I was really in it for the music. Like, although I think I dressed pretty well, you know, cared about my appearance, there wasn't any idea of, well, I'm going to play and I'm going to be winking at some guy at the bar. I wanted so much for the music to be accepted, and I really wanted to play as well as I could, and that's always been in the forefront, you know, to try to play as well as I could. Although at that time I think I was rather dependent upon the opinion of other people. I mean, I'm not so much that anymore. I've sort of become my own person a little more than I was then.
Well, speaking of the opinion of other people, I was reading a Newsweek review of your work from December 30th of 1957.
Oh, my God!
And it said that you played, quote, a romantic arrangement of On the Alamo. And then a little later, her style turned masculine and aggressive as she swung into From This Moment On. And I love that because I don't think that they would have called it a romantic arrangement if it was a man playing a ballad. And then as it was aggressive, it turned masculine. And you must have run into that a lot.
Yeah, that it's funny because after a while, that did start to annoy me. And I would think every time that you would get a little stronger or more forceful. They didn't say that. They didn't call it strong or forceful. It was either aggressive or masculine. And so people would say to me, oh, you play just like a man. Or else they'd say, oh, you play good for a girl. And after a while, in the beginning, I sort of took everything as a compliment. But then I would think, well, why does it have to be aggressive? I don't like that word. It just makes me feel so that I'm sort of hunching my shoulders and punching the piano. You know, why does it have to be aggressive? Why can't it just be with more strength or more a more forceful player? So gradually over the years, I think all that stuff has changed. I've noticed nobody says that anymore.
Right. Did you feel initially uncomfortable in the jazz life as an upper-middle-class British woman? Were you made to feel uncomfortable by that? Did you try to...
You mean to get down and to be one of the boys?
Right, exactly. Right. Well, a lot of people go through this, you know, that they're just a little embarrassed about their proper upbringing, and they try to be more down or more bohemian or whatever.
No, I think I was always myself in that regard. In fact, but people used to kid me either about my accent, but I really was one of the group. I mean, I wasn't somebody that sort of was a snob. I think, I mean, although I came, I feel that my family were snobs. My mother was very careful about, she didn't let me mingle with certain kinds of people. Well, that's why they were so upset about me being in the music business, because they felt that everybody in music had to be weird or a bohemian or strange. You know, some of the strangest people I've ever met have had nothing to do with music. I think musicians, for the most part, are a very normal lot of people, and certainly more fun. And they, a musician is something really extra special, more different from other people in a good way. I don't know how to explain it.
In your new book, you mentioned that a lot of women singers influenced your playing. And, you know, women singers have always been accepted more than women instrumentalists.
Oh, definitely. That's a whole other breed. Yeah, singers. I don't know why that is. Well, because every band had the girl singer. And, you know, that's a whole other story. I don't even want to get into that. I would hate to have been a girl singer, because I feel that you're really fair game then when you're traveling on with a busload of guys. And that must have been awfully hard.
And you had to dress more sexy too.
Oh, sure.
Low-cut gowns and things like that when you were the quote girl singer. You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers, well, early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording, and then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow upward.
It's amazing,
rise, and every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful. And it's I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I think. Well, I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else, and I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, that you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more, I should be able to play more, and I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling. I think, well, you should be able to do better. You should be able to play better. You should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote, yeah, a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
You know, probably
the wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had, and you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
You've, as a musician, had to be on the road a lot during your life that you've been lucky enough to have very long stays at certain clubs, like the Cafe Carlyle in New York and the Hickory House in New York. But I think life on the road is the downfall of a lot of performers, and it's in part how they end up on drugs or alcohol. Was it hard to not give in to temptations like that, especially probably with some of the, not peer pressure exactly, but when you're hanging out with people and everybody's going drinking after the set, you know?
Oh, I had my share of drinks, but I always had that feeling about, like, years ago when we used to be hanging out in pubs in England, it was always, you know, you're supposed to be able to drink and hold it. You're not supposed to get drunk. You know, it's sort of undignified and terrible, undignified thing to do. So I could never, ever see myself getting out of control. I mean, I used to like to have drinks at the Hickory House. In fact, I used to like to pour a straight shot when nobody was looking. I thought I was really getting back at the owner. I would get one of the bottles. You know, we were surrounded by bottles on the bandstand. And when nobody was looking, I would pour myself a shot and drink it, you know, and sort of one up for me. But as far as pot or any of the other things, I wouldn't do that to myself. I mean, I did smoke a little pot, but just once or twice. But it never affected me in a good way. And a bass player once said to me, "Oh, but Marion, you really have to learn how to handle that. You have to get used to being able to handle it." I said, "Well, if I have to do that, then I don't want to do it." And I've never done anything that would get in the way of playing, although I can see how that would be a hang-up for some people, because I think one has that feeling of wanting to be on top and be the best you can possibly be every night, and that if you take something that's going to help you be that way, temptation is to be wanting to do that every night.
You know, our listeners who are familiar with your Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz series will, I'm sure, want to know if you have a new series, a new round of programs in the works.
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we're going to start taping in October. And I'm looking forward to having Claude Bowling on the show. In fact, I think this will give me a chance to maybe try to learn one of his pieces. He has some wonderful stuff written out, but now I'll be interested to see what he does improvising. Then I'm also going to have Harold Mayburn. He said he'll do the show. Hilton Ruiz. And if I can get the date together, T. Carson, who now plays in the Basie Band.
Well, I wish you the best with the new series, and I thank you very much.
Are we done?
For being with us. Yeah, the time just flew by. Thank you so much for being here, Marion McPartland.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
My guest has been jazz pianist Marion McPartland. If you'd like to hear more of her playing, there's her radio series on many NPR stations around the country, and she has a new album called Marion McPartland Plays the Music of Billy Strayhorn on Concord Records. She also has a new book called All in Good Time, and it features profiles she's written over the years of many of her fellow musicians. All in Good Time is published by the Oxford University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Thomas Hollywood Henderson. In the 1970s, he was a star football player for the Dallas Cowboys, but drugs and drinking led to his downfall. He's given them up, and he's written a memoir about his life, so I hope you can join us. Here's more music from Marion McPartland's new album. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Michael Denneny, the editor of Stonewall Inn Editions. It's a new line of books aimed at a growing market, gay readers. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward reviews the rise and fall of the Chantels, the girl group from the 50s that paved the way for groups like the Shirelles and the Ronettes. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Toni Morrison. It's called Beloved, and it's the first novel in 7 years from one of America's most highly regarded black women authors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. A federal judge in Georgia today struck down a state law requiring minors to notify their parents before having an abortion. The district court judge found two provisions of the law unconstitutional, but said state officials could easily remedy the two problems. Planned Parenthood organizations in Georgia had challenged the law. They argued that it violated a woman's right to privacy and due process. Congressional investigators have released a memo prepared for Vice President George Bush months before the Iran-Contra scandal broke. It says a former CIA agent wanted to meet with Bush to discuss the secret Contra supply network. It's unclear whether the vice president ever saw the memo. He has said he knew nothing about the supply operation. And in a deposition also released by congressional panels today, a Bush aide says the subject of Contra supplies never came up when Bush met with the CIA agent. The leaders of the two Germanys concluded their formal talks today in Bonn. The two signed three agreements calling for closer trade, increased scientific and cultural exchanges, and eased travel restrictions across their borders. The BBC's Diana Goodman has a report.
With the formal working part of the visit over and a joint communique agreed, the two sides have begun to take stock. The West Germans have said that despite all the differences that remain, the talks were a success, and every chance to work together will be seized. An East German spokesman said Herr Honecker had told Chancellor Kohl that by answering one confidence with another, things had started to move, and East Germany was also determined to follow that path. Certainly, Chancellor Kohl's acceptance of Herr Honecker's invitation to visit East Germany is another important step forward in relations between the two countries. And although the only tangible results of the visit are three agreements signed today on nuclear safety, scientific cooperation, and the environment, the joint communique includes a special pledge that both sides will work towards a further easing of restrictions on travel.
The BBC's Diana Goodman. President Reagan today outlined his plans for his last 16 months in office for a group of top administration appointees. On Central America, the president said, despite the flurry of news from the region in recent weeks, the real issue remains peace and democracy. And he said the administration has no plans to abandon the Contra rebels in Nicaragua.
We share their desire for peace, prosperity, and democracy. And we will support them in that quest just as we've supported them in the past. We will not accept a mere semblance of democracy.
The president also predicted that his nominee to replace Justice Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court will be confirmed by the Senate. Mr. Reagan said Robert Bork is a people's judge who believes in judicial restraint. Chicago teachers went on strike today, delaying the start of classes for some 480,000 students. The Chicago Teachers Union wants a 10% pay hike for its 29,000 members. The school board says it doesn't have the money. Union President Jacqueline Vaughn says she doesn't accept the board's position.
I have told the board, we consider what we have on the table as reasonable. We also are reasonable enough to understand that they have to use the dollars they have, but they haven't even offered to do that, and that's unreasonable.
Meanwhile, Detroit school teachers have been on strike since last week, affecting 180,000 students. Education Secretary William Bennett today outlined a scorecard voters can use to see where presidential candidates stand on education issues. He says voters need more than platitudes about deep concern and promises of more money. He says Democrats should be judged on their willingness to break ranks with the National Education Association by supporting merit pay, and Republicans should be asked if they're committed to education for poor kids. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a portrait of the first girl group that made a name singing harmonies in New York City, the Chantels. The liner notes on one of their albums read, "The Chantels with their swinging tunes have beat the Russians to the moon." But Ed tells us they didn't achieve such heights without paying a price.
Ask any kid in a band, how badly do you want to make a hit record? What would you be willing to do for it? What's really amazing is how few would-be rock and roll stars have any idea what they might be up against. On the one hand, you can call it naive, while on the other hand, you could call it innocent. And despite all the horror stories you've heard, the innocent don't always lose out in the rock and roll business. Take, for instance, the story of the Chantels. When they hit the scene in 1957 with The Plea, which we just heard, the Chantels were an impossible novelty. At the time, street corner harmony was a guy's business, and New York had hundreds of boys looking for that big break. Maybe that's why Richard Barrett, waiting to go on stage with his group The Valentines at a Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers show, thought he was onto something when he heard the five girls harmonizing in the backstage area. He wasn't the first to figure it out. Their schoolmates at St. Anthony of Padua had often remarked that they didn't sound like five girls. They sounded like a choir, a very young choir. Lois Harris, Sonia Goring, and Jackie Landry were all 16 years old, but Renee Minas and the remarkable lead singer Arlene Smith were only 13. Still, as Frankie Lyman had shown, youth was no barrier to talent, and so Richard Barrett took the Chantels into the studio and cut The Plea and He's Gone. Trouble was, He's Gone was the side they pushed, and once you get past that ethereal opening, it's a pretty standard tune. But Barrett was determined. He had plenty of songs, it seemed, and just needed the one special one that would capture Arlene Smith's amazing voice. In 1958, he found it. When he played Maybe for George Goldner of End Records, for whom he and the Chantels recorded, Goldner agreed that that was the song. He took the girls into the studio again and started recording. Legend has it that it was one of the most brutal recording sessions of all time. Goldner harassed Arlene, told her she was no good, that she was wasting his time, that she'd be sorry. They'd record a take, and he'd tell her it was worse than the one before. Finally, hours after they'd begun, the piano player, Raul J. Sita, counted off the intro once again, and they had it. Innocence has its rewards. After trying a solo career, Arlene Smith went to Juilliard and worked for a while as a studio singer. She married and had a few kids and lives today in New York. Although she gave up the music business a long time ago, from time to time she gets together with reunited harmony groups like the Jive Five or the Harptones just for the fun of it. Maybe sold a million copies in 1958 and opened the door for the girl groups who came later. And Arlene Smith found out what a hit record can cost.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. That's the Chantels on Fresh Air. A major mainstream publishing house has taken a big step towards recognizing the marketability of books by and about gays. St. Martin's Press has just launched a new line of gay paperbacks. It's called Stonewall Inn Editions. The name pays homage to a New York gay bar where, in 1969, gays fought back against a police raid. That event was a turning point in the early history of the gay liberation movement. My guest, Michael Denneny, is a senior editor at St. Martin's and the general editor of Stonewall Inn Editions. He's also one of the founders of the gay publication Christopher Street. Denneny thinks it's time that gay writers are accepted by the general literary establishment.
Well, it seemed to me there was a second generation of gay writers coming along who were very exciting, and I wanted to find some way to get to a wider audience than the people who had been reading and buying the cloth books. So I thought I would try a trade paper line.
When you say a second generation of gay writers, how was this generation different from the first generation of gay writers?
Well, I think the first generation of really openly gay writers in the 70s, people like Ed White, Andrew Holleran, Larry Kramer, Felice Picano, they were the first people to come out publicly and to risk their careers doing it. And when the second generation of writers came along, it was a much more accepted thing. I mean, the novels didn't have to be as political. They were about, rather than being about gay life, they were about life as it was experienced by a gay man.
There have been a number of small presses devoted to books by gay and lesbian authors. I think that the fact that a mainstream publishing company would devote a line to gay books, shows that the gay market is being taken more seriously. Do you think that that's true?
Yeah, I think it's a market that's really coming into existence. It's an interesting phenomenon because actually the writers are there first, and it's as if the audience is coming to existence around them, you know, making a circle of people around the writers wanting to listen to them. This is a bit unfortunate from the author's point of view to be there first because they're not quite making the money they'd make if the audience was already established. But it really is a process of building an audience.
It's sometimes very difficult for serious fiction to find its readership, especially if you're a first-time novelist. Is it an advantage, do you think, to have a built-in audience that, that say, a gay novel might have?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, if you publish a first novel, it's an amazingly uphill fight. Somebody once said that publishing a first novel is like dropping a rose petal down the Grand Canyon and waiting to hear an echo. And it basically, that's a good analogy. Here you have the context of a community. Even though the sales figures aren't that large yet, you get the advantage that there are people that are really waiting for the next novels. There's a coherent audience that tends to read all the other gay novels. And this situation, I think, is very good for a writer.
We're talking about gay readers, but do you assume that only gay readers read books by gay writers?
I think that has been true up to about now, that basically it was a specialized audience, and most of the sales of any gay book you could pretty much be sure were to gay people. That seems to me to be changing. I think what we're seeing happen is somewhat like what happened with black women writers about 10 or 15 years ago, when for some reason, and you can never know why this happens, but all of a sudden there were people like Toni Morrison, Entezake Shange, Alice Walker, Gloria Naylor. You had this enormous resurgence of writing by black women writers, you know, a renaissance, which has continued up to our own day. I think it's one of the strongest impulses in, you know, literary history right now. And I think a parallel thing is happening with gay writers.
You came of age before the gay liberation movement. Were there many books that you could read that were about being gay?
No. Very, very few. And I was always excited the minute I found any one of them.
How would you find them? Word of mouth?
Word of mouth, by sheer accident. You know, just suddenly reading something or reading an author and suddenly realizing this was a gay book. But in fact, there was very little available.
Does it make you feel more marginalized when you can't find characters like yourself in the books that you read?
Oh, for sure. For sure. That's why I got into this originally. By around 74 or 75, I was basically known in publishing as a woman's editor because I was doing a lot of women's books by and about women. And it suddenly hit me that I was never doing any books that were about my own life, you know, about the experiences my friends and I had. It took me a couple of years to wake up to that, but then I said, this is silly. You know, I'm perfectly happy publishing and reading these books by women, which I thought were extraordinarily interesting. I wanted to see some books that had to do with my own problems, lifestyle, community, society. I think it's natural for people to want to see their life reflected in the literature, the art that they have. So I made a political decision to try to see if I could start publishing gay books and whether or not there was a future in that. And for a while, until the late 70s, it looked a little wobbly. I wasn't sure. But then, as I say, the second generation of writers came along and continues to come along. I mean, I'm introducing a new gay author almost every season now, which is quite remarkable.
How long ago did you get into the publishing industry?
About, when is it? 16 years. 16 years ago. I worked at Macmillan for 5 years, and I've worked for the last 11 years at St. Martin's.
Were you openly gay when you started in the industry?
No. When I started at Macmillan, that was 1971, I wasn't openly gay at all. By the end of my tenure there, I was, because I'd been involved in the founding of Christopher Street. And much to my surprise, Christopher Street was sort of widely read in the publishing industry. I've never quite understood that. So whether I liked it or not, I was fairly out after that.
Did it change your status at all, or did it change the kinds of books that you were given to edit?
No, I don't think so. And I haven't come across a problem. with anybody. I mean, the first time I met with G. Gordon Liddy, I figured I ought to put it on the table. And I said, Gordon, this is a very expensive restaurant, and we're going to have a very nice meal, so we might as well find out if this would be a problem working together, and if so, we can just forget about it and have a good meal. He had no problem whatsoever. And in fact, when he went on tour, he went out of his way to talk about having a gay editor.
So do you work exclusively now with gay writers?
Oh, no. It's about a quarter of the authors that I have. I do all sorts of things, murder mysteries, poetry, Entezaki Shange's novels and plays. I'm hoping to get Gordon Liddy to write a new novel. Now it's about, I would say, 20, maybe 25% of what I do.
Well, I'm sure that there are many, many gay writers knocking at your door now, wanting in on this new line. Does that put you in a funny situation?
It puts me in a situation of having to read an incredible amount.
It also puts you in the position of having to say no to a lot of people.
Right, right. And that gets awkward. And especially the hardest part is I'm seeing a very large number of novels written about AIDS, most of them written, you know, out of feelings of great grief and anger. And this is very hard to read. It's hard to read 3 or 4 of those a week. But out of that are going to come some incredible books.
The books that you've brought out so far are by men. Do you have any lesbian writers that you'll be bringing out?
I don't. That's sort of an open question. I have published several lesbian writers. Noretta Kurtzka's 2 novels, Judy Grand's poetry. I don't know. We really haven't made a decision on the line, although it's beginning to look like the line will be a male line.
What's the reason for that?
The audiences are quite different. I'm much more familiar with what's happening in gay male writing than I am with lesbian writing. There are several lesbian presses that do extraordinarily good jobs. The distribution system is different. There's about 80 or 90 feminist bookstores in this country, and while they're not lesbian, they're feminist, they do carry the gay women's literature. I just think they're, you know, it's a different community to some extent, a different culture, and I'm not anywhere near as well-versed. I don't know as many writers in it.
So you think this is a job for somebody else?
Probably, yeah. I couldn't handle another one at this point.
Michael Denneny is a senior editor at St. Martin's Press and general editor of Stonewall Inn Editions, a new line of gay paperback books. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert, and
Hello,
welcome back from vacation.
Thank you very much.
What stories are you following?
Well, we'll have a report by Jim Angle on new transcripts of closed-door testimony released, testimony about Vice President George Bush and the Contra resupply effort. We also have a special report by reporter Richard Gonzalez about the terrorist campaign in Mozambique against the government there. Some say it's backed by South Africa. The South Africans deny that. And we also take a look at the presidential primary campaigns with political correspondent Linda Wertheimer to find out where we stand now that we've passed Labor Day.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist Toni Morrison is one of the most eloquent voices on the black experience in America. In 1977, she won the National Book Critics Circle Award for her novel Song of Solomon. Morrison's new book, Beloved, is her first novel in 7 years. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
Toni Morrison's masterwork is a ghost story about history. At its very center is an act as awful as anything imagined by the Old Testament and the Greeks, the sacrifice of a child. But first, we must circle around through everything we'd prefer to forget about ourselves as a nation. Seth, a teenaged mother of 3 and pregnant with her 4th, is a runaway slave. This is what she leaves behind in 1854 in a river passage from the Sweet Home Plantation of Kentucky to the Free State of Ohio. A husband driven mad at her violation by white masters, whippings that left a scar tree on her back that flowered red roses, black boys hanging from the most beautiful sycamore trees in the world, laughing dead men who wore three-spoke collars on their necks and iron bits in their mouths, and who would, before, during, and after the Civil War, be sold to rock piles and chain gangs, sleep in coffins, hide in caves, fight for food with owls and pigs, and astonish themselves with the beauty of a land that was not theirs. According to Paul D., the last of the Sweet Home men, on nights when the sky was personal, weak with the weight of its own stars, he made himself not love it. According to Seth, it made her wonder if hell was a pretty place too. Paul D. won't find Seth and her daughter Denver for 19 years. Then he will chase a spiteful ghost from their house in Cincinnati. But he won't know the ghost's name, nor how to cope with the young woman, beloved, who replaces that ghost. He won't know that the fugitive Seth enjoyed just one whole moon of unslaved life before the white men arrived on horseback, and Seth, like a black Medea, raised a handsaw, and Denver swallowed her sister's blood right along with her mother's milk. Who is beloved with the unlined midnight skin? Beloved swam up from death, up through flowers and diamonds and iron circles, up out of blue water, to eat all the love that was left in the world. She is the devouring past, all that is unforgiven and denied. It's impossible in this brief compass to do more than hint at Morrison's many wonders. Beloved evokes the land as if another D.H. Lawrence were at work, or another Gauguin. It acquaints us with the unendingness of women's work, even out of slavery. It is the epic song and sadness of the people of the broken necks, of fire-cooked blood and black girls who had lost their ribbons. It is the stuff of fairy tales, from Denver's emerald light to the madness of hummingbirds with needle beaks as lost children are offered up to a shameful god. That's a sufficiency. But there's much, much more. It's not enough to say that the author of Song of Solomon has written another splendid novel. Beloved belongs on the highest shelf of American literature, even if half a dozen canonized white boys have to be elbowed off. The thing is, now I can't imagine American literature without it. Without Beloved, our imagination of the nation's self has a hole in it big enough to die from.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Toni Morrison's new novel, Beloved. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with cartoonist Matt Groening, creator of the syndicated comic Life in Hell, and author of the books School is Hell, Work is Hell, and Love is Hell, which each star a lot of really depressed rabbits. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review recordings of Gershwin songs featuring singer Kiri Takanawa and conductor John McGlynn. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss how the French are circling the wagons against American expressions. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.